There are some people who talk and some people who don't. Which means that there are some people who leave this place and some who do not leave. You are obviously staying.
Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I know too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth as the village. Yes.
That is my hope. What's yours?
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Was the Lockerbie bomb planted by CIA drug runners killing off honest agents who were about to dob them in? Also, award-winning journalist and TV documentary producer Tim Tate we hear from tonight. He lives here in the Southwest. In the early 1990s, he made an hour-long documentary called Conspiracy of Silence for the Discovery Channel, which was never shown. Documentary was about a care home, child prostitution and drug running ring with collusion by the FBI at the very top of the Republican Party in the United States in Nebraska and Washington DC. This week he gives us his diagnosis of the death of British TV investigative journalism. Also, Frenchay Hospital, a community hospital, was promised on the old site, which is now being developed for luxury homes. Barbara Harris joins us with Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group and Save Frenchay Community Hospital Group. And Lockerbie, we heard a few weeks ago from the father of one of the victims, Jim Swire. The Lockerbie bomb certainly wasn't loaded up in Malta, and a break-in which was kept secret in Heathrow, suggesting the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 may have been the work of the Western Security Services. So for more insight this evening on the reality behind the Lockerbie bombing, we speak to Susan Lindauer, who's a former CIA agent who's calling in from the United States. Hi, Susan, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. It's great to be on with you. People may say to themselves, why does Lockerbie matter now? Because it's 25 years old, but there is a very important reason, and that is the CIA continues to control and dominate the heroin and opium trade. We know that it's very disconcerting, and if we don't confront this, it will continue until we do.
Okay, what evidence have you got, Susan, for that?
Well, we know that American soldiers are coming back from Afghanistan furiously unhappy that they've been posted to guard poppy fields. And we know that this is becoming a critical financial mechanism for the black budgets in the United States. And we know that essentially the CIA trafficking is putting the CIA in the drug lord business. And the CIA may be the drug kingpin.
Okay, so what do you mean by the black budget?
Well, the black budgets are the operational monies for Afghanistan, for Syria, for training and creating the militancy groups that we now know as Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra, the Free Syrian Army, operations all through the world. But it means it's off the books. The Senate Intelligence Committee has passed a law declaring that black budget monies must never be audited by Congress. The Congress actually passed a law saying that it would be illegal to inform Congress of the uses of the money, the quantities of the money, and that Congress must never, by law, must not be held accountable for what the black budgets are used for.
Okay, before we get into Lockerbie's, Susan, just tell us your story, because you had a bit of a rough ride as someone who'd been working for the CIA, didn't you?
Well, my background is very important on Libya. I was the chief CIA asset covering Iraq and Libya from 1995 to 2003. I covered the embassies as a back channel in New York at the United Nations. So I was meeting about every 3 weeks with Iraqi and Libyan diplomats. I am the one who started the Lockerbie negotiations for the handover of the two Libyans for trial. And I can tell you from my own direct personal knowledge and my own direct involvement that the very first conversations with the Libyan diplomats stated up front, because I'm the one who said it, I'm the one who did it, we said up front, we know that you are innocent. We know that Libya had nothing to do with this trial. The diplomat was floored. He said, he was like, oh, thank you, CIA. He laughed. He was amazed. But I am a very, brutally honest, messenger. I'll tell you the truth, and it's not going to be watered down. It's not going to be prettied up. It's going to be direct, because that's how I am as a person. And I just told them, we know you did not do this. The American families of Lockerbie, more than the Scottish families, but the American families, are demanding a trial. The only way we are ever going to convince them of Libya's innocence is if we show them a trial where the evidence is presented, that the trial will satiate their need for justice, and then they're going to be confronted with the fact that all the evidence points somewhere else. And if they have any shred of, paternal, filial decency, they're going to want to know who really did it. Once we show them that this is impossible, the scenario that they have latched on psychologically, the psychological problem was that the families were bitterly attached to the Libyan story. And they wanted it so badly, and it's just not true. They are innocent. Megrahi was an innocent man. I am so grateful that the Prime Minister of England let him go free, because he never deserved that. I was so relieved when FEMA, the other Libya, and I'm the one who did the negotiations for the trial. I'm the one who had to persuade Libya to do this. And I'm telling you that I was so grateful and so pleased and relieved when the other Libyan, Mr. FEMA, was sent home.
Can you give us a bit of detail, Susan, about what was cooked up at the trial? You're saying that it was basically a show trial. So in what way was evidence cooked up?
It was a ridiculous story. It was a ridiculous... Let me tell you what really happened in Lockerbie. And again, this is important because the CIA is continuing to generate trillions, hundreds of billions of dollars in off-the-books money for black operations. And everybody knows what black ops are. I don't need to explain that. This is operations money across the world, especially in the Middle East where we're seeing such tension and trouble. So we need to really get this under control, because this is the source of funding for the shadow government. Okay, but let me tell you what really happened on Lockerbie. There was a rogue team the CIA had legitimately believed that they needed to infiltrate the Islamic Jihad community, which was holding the Western hostages, 96 high-profile Western hostages, including Terry Anderson, the Associated Press correspondent, Jerry Levin, the CNN bureau chief, Mr. Buckley, who was the CIA station chief in Beirut, and he, Mr. Buckley had been viciously, savagely tortured. He was a political target of the highest value, and they beat him with chains and bricks. They electrocuted the man. They tore out his toenails. They did every possible thing that you could imagine. Jerry Levin has said that he was held locked in a basement, chained to the floor for 3 years with a bucket to pee in. I'm sorry to be graphic, but these were horrible situations. And the CIA believed that they needed to infiltrate the Islamic Jihad community in order to get the hostages out. The problem was, and this was already controversial, because what they had to do, they made a deal with the devil. They had to agree to move heroin, but that's why they did it. Okay, I just told you why they did it, but here's what it required. They had to make a deal with the devil to move heroin out of Beirut, through Frankfurt Airport, through Heathrow Airport, and on to New York. And they had baggage handlers who would literally just, you know, who were paid off to look the other way and move the right suitcases through on a periodic basis, so that the heroin would keep moving through this pipeline all the way through Frankfurt, through London, and into New York.
And so, how did this enable the CIA to infiltrate into the Islamic groups then, this drug run?
Well, the Islamic Jihad group was using heroin to finance its war against Israel and to finance the civil war that Lebanon was fighting. And so, but what happened was even worse than that, because there was a rogue CIA team. And the CIA team included Oliver North of Iran-Contra notoriety and some other people associated with Iran-Contra. And they recognized that they were getting filthy rich off this for them in their own private bank accounts. Not all of it was going to the operations. It was also going to their own private bank accounts. Anyway, so what they did was they went rogue, and they began to warn. The purpose of the operation was supposed to be that they would infiltrate the Islamic Jihad, which is now called Hezbollah, and they would infiltrate them, and they would identify where the hostages were being held, and then they would go in, and they would be able to call in a rescue and do a raid and seize the hostages, and they'd save the hostages. And this was how they rationalized it. When they went rogue, somebody began to warn the Islamic Jihad who was when the Delta Force and the Americans were about to swoop in. So exactly at the moment that they were about to come in and save the hostages, they would come in, that the Islamic Jihad would suddenly move them. And the American side would have to start all over again to find these people where they had been moved to, where they had been transported to. And this was a very dangerous operation. Every time somebody had to start over again, there was more risk of more hostages, there was more risk they would be killed. To put this in context, Terry Anderson was held for 7 years. Jerry Levin was held for 3 years. Because of this deception and this rogue agent. So the Defense Intelligence Agency, which also had a team there, reported to Langley. Sorry for this long buildup. The Defense Intelligence Agency called in the FBI, and they said, "We think we have a traitor who is profiting from the heroin, who's ratting us out to Hezbollah, and we need you to come in and arrest these people and get them out of our way so we can finish this operation." Well, that was, the FBI did send in a team, and the team that the FBI sent gathered evidence of heroin trafficking, gathered money, and they were flying back on Pan Am 103 when the heroin suitcase was switched with a bomb. Okay? And to be honest with you, I've been told this was done in Frankfurt, not Heathrow. I believe in good faith to Jim Swire that he is mistaken. I know he says it was done in Heathrow. It was not. It's my understanding it was done in Frankfurt.
Okay, well, to be fair to Jim, he was saying that there was a break-in, and so there is some evidence that it was swapped in Heathrow. What have you heard, and what's the veracity of what you've heard about it, the suitcases being swapped in Frankfurt instead, which was where the plane was before?
I've been told that the man who put the bomb on the airplane lives in the suburbs of Washington, 6 miles from my house. The man who did this was the nephew of was the nephew of the famous terrorist whose name now escapes me. I'm sorry. It'll come in a second. And he lives in Fairfax County. He lives about 6 miles from the White House.
Okay, so who was actually on that plane then, and what were they about to do when they got back to the United States?
The people on the airplane that had to be killed off were the FBI team with the drugs and the money, the defense intelligence team that had filed the complaint against the CIA, and the deputy station chief of the CIA, who was flying back to answer charges against his team. And when you killed off those people, you killed off the knowledge base, the institutional knowledge that had assimilated that was capable of putting all the pieces together.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned Oliver North being involved in this, because, of course, he was one of the kingpins in the Iran-Contra scandal, and also he was pardoned by George Bush Sr. What sort of operation was he running? And also, I wonder what you think about how the Lockerbie bombing then affected the way that these rogue elements within the CIA were able to thrive in the future.
Well, first of all, the nephew, the name of the man is Ahmed. The five, there are four or five people who are key people. Ahmed Jibril, that's the name that was escaping me for a second. His nephew is the one who put the bomb on the plane. Ahmed Jibril. And what they did was they switched the heroin suitcase for the bomb. Okay. Abu Nidal has confessed. Abu Nidal was killed in a shootout in Baghdad with Saddam's forces, and he confessed, and his people, his family and friends stood by that story, and they insisted that he was the mastermind. And what had happened was that the rogue team had warned Ahmed Jibril and that crew that what the CIA was doing, and that the CIA was and the FBI were onto the game, and they were going to shut it down and everybody was going to be in trouble. So at that point, they knew they'd been busted, and then they took action to protect the secrecy of the operation. But everybody who did it has been protected. This is a very damaging. You know, why do we have? I think that it's self-evident why the CIA. Once you understand the truth, it's self-evident why the CIA has to stop this story from ever coming out. This is a long-term, this is the beginning of a drug cartel at the CIA. These people have never been caught, they've never been prosecuted, and the CIA has continued right up to the current day to exploit drug sales, heroin sales particularly heroin, in the global market to raise operational money.
I suppose the other aspect of this, Susan, is that it's going to send a very, very strong signal to anybody that tries to do something to investigate or to bring the law to bear on people who are in the CIA or other Western intelligence services who are drug runners. This sends a very strong signal, doesn't it? The knowledge of what really happened at Lockerbie.
Yes, it does. It does. But it also the truth disparages good efforts by good people as well. Not everybody at the CIA is doing really ugly things, but you have a cabal of black assets who commit atrocities and really serious crimes, who then damage and cause what we call blowback on other operations which might have legitimacy. And so therefore, it always surprises people that you have this, we have our little intelligence wars where good people are trying to clean up and push out the bad people and push them back so that good things can be done as well. And it's just a shame. I mean, it may sound naive to you, but as somebody who did Lockerbie, who did Libya for 7 or 8 years, I can honestly say that my operation, truly my operation directly with the Libyans, my back channel with Libya, directly stopped any war, any military confrontation with the United States for 15 years. I mean, you know, negotiations and dialogue and diplomacy, even back-channel diplomacy, are a tremendous tension release. It's a valve, a pressure valve. And if you can solve small problems on the edges, you can, you know, even if you can't deal with the bigger problems, you can still relieve enough pressure that you can stop tensions from blowing out into full-scale war.
But you're painting a picture, Susan. You're painting a picture of a CIA nowadays. You're painting a picture of a CIA nowadays, which has been almost thoroughly infiltrated by a kind of mafia.
Yes, it is being infiltrated by a mafia, and that's a really dangerous. That's dangerous because, as I said at the very beginning, the United States Senate has passed laws. Congress has passed laws prohibiting any reports to Congress. I went to my own senator, Barbara Mikulski, and I reported on thefts off the black budget and abuses of the black budget, and I received a phone call. I reported this to her chief of staff, and I received a phone call from the Capitol Hill police threatening me that I must never come back to Congress and report crimes off the of the black budget ever again.
No, the victims of Lockerbie, Susan, are just one of the aspects of the victims of all this. But, of course, there are millions of victims now in Libya. Libya is a failed state. It's in a terrible situation. I just wonder how that makes you feel, because you must have spent quite a lot of time in Libya and seen how it was before and how it is now.
Well, my work was at the United Nations, and what I saw was Libya, at the time that I first contacted them, was a deeply paranoid state like North Korea. They were convinced of the hostility of the Western world towards them as personally, and they felt they were completely isolated. In 1995, early 1995, they were completely isolated. And so what happened was, over a period of years, we persuaded Libya to drop its guard and to trust the international community and come out and see, we're not going to hurt you. We're going to be receptive and respectful. We're going to listen to what Colonel Gaddafi has to say, even if he gives a speech that takes 4 hours. We're going to show maturity in our dealings, and we're going to build some rapprochement that includes getting rid of terrorists, getting terrorists out of the country. In order to do this, we didn't just have the handover of the two men. Libya had to stop sponsoring terrorism as a whole, as a country. And this was a big deal. They had to deport those people that were already taking sanctuary in Libya. And so this was they had to get rid of their weapons of mass destruction. Well, as soon as they'd done that, to me it's just a tragedy, because Libya had obeyed all the requirements that we had set down for them. Libya honored that. It was hard to get them to do it too. They were so convinced we were going to declare war on them. We were going to bomb them if they gave up their weapons of mass destruction. We'd come and send NATO bombs and NATO ships and attack them, which is, gosh, of course, exactly what we did. We make an argument that disarmament, our actions cast very serious doubts on whether disarmament is a safe policy for these people.
But what about the situation, Susan? What about the situation over in...
If I was talking to the Iranians, I would tell them not to do it.
What about the situation over in Libya, though? Because a lot of people have pointed to the fact that Colonel Gaddafi was not indebted to the IMF at all. In fact, he was starting a thing called the Libyan gold dinar, the African gold dinar, which was actually putting up a kind of competition. Really, the idea really being to free Africa from the IMF debt.
Libya was a success. Libya was doing beautifully well. Libya had high literacy, great educational rights for women, job opportunities for women. How the West has destroyed this country is sickening. It is a complete, and it's a complete fraud to blame it on Lockerbie. One of the reasons that I came out so powerfully against the war was that I was determined that they would, that Washington and London would never use Lockerbie as an excuse for NATO bombings. I just put a stop to that. I was like, this is just not going to happen.
Okay, well, Susan, just to wrap up...
You're not going to use Lockerbie to do it.
Which, of course, they did use it as an excuse, certainly, in this country. Anyway, Susan, just to wrap up, can you tell us how listeners can follow your work? Have you got a blog? Where can we find you online?
My book, you can go to Amazon.com in Europe and check out my book, Extreme Prejudice, which tells the story of... my work as an asset, and then my later arrest on the Patriot Act and my imprisonment on Carswell Air Force Base.
And what about, do you have a blog or something where you're writing nowadays?
I don't. Not at the moment. Not one that's active.
Hey, well, your book is Extreme Prejudice. It's been a great pleasure to have you speaking to us in Bristol here and online, of course, to the people listening on the streaming on the internet. Susan Lindauer, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
And now Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, maybe you'd like to comment on what Susan had to said there, because it was almost taking the whole Lockerbie story on from what we heard from Jim Swire, the father of one of the victims of Lockerbie who lives in Gloucestershire here.
Yeah, well, if you remember, one of the things that we were discussing was the possibility that the bomb had gone on in Beirut, not at Frankfurt, and that it had been basically put on by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. That's Abu Nidal's group, the guy who died in a shootout with Saddam's security forces.
But it's fascinating that we've got people like Susan around, who was a key person at the time, has managed to survive all the way through it, has kept the knowledge base that many people have lost. The people over the years have actually come to her saying, well, actually, I've got a little piece of the Lockerbie jigsaw.
Yes, and I think I listen to what she's saying. I mean, Abu Nidal and the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine General Command were a split off the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and there's quite a lot of evidence that they were in fact run by the Israelis. So there's an Israeli potential connection with them. The take home, of course, is that the story, the official story about Lockerbie, is patently rubbish, and it is patently rubbish because, of course, they were only implicated because of the so-called circuit board that was found at the scene. But they had to release Megrahi. Alex Salmond had to release Megrahi because a Scottish police inspector was going to testify at the appeal that the circuit board had been planted by the CIA.
But they were also linked through, I believe, the purchase of some clothes that were found in a suitcase on the plane by Megrahi in Malta.
But you think about this for a minute, and lots of people out there will have been on aeroplanes. Do you find it credible that a suitcase with clothes in surrounding a bomb goes on in Malta without a passport, without a passenger and without a passport, goes to Frankfurt, gets transferred onto a new plane, and then's flown to Heathrow and transferred again? I just don't believe that. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, the idea was that these were bags that were scheduled to be taken from one plane to another, as the passenger
as you well know, anybody anybody who's travelled on an aircraft, passengers and bags are constantly checked to make sure there's no more, the same passengers and the same bags are all linked. And in any case, just think of it logically, when a bomb goes off, there is no circuit board left. It's vaporised.
Okay, what's the take home from what Susan's been saying about the international drug trade, well, and heroin trade? Well, because one of the things which has come out since the invasion of Afghanistan, of course, and many would point back to Indochina and the Vietnam War as being largely about controlling opium crops, heroin crops, that sort of thing. What's the take home about what we were hearing there about Afghanistan and opium?
Well, the CIA have been involved in drug running since the 1940s. They were originally working with the Chinese nationalists to bring heroin into the United States to fund the Chinese nationalists. And the purpose of this, for the CIA's point of view, is quite simple. If you've got a slush fund that you've developed by allowing drugs to be run, then effectively you don't have to account for that to anybody, and it gives you a money to spend in Colombia. The popular movement in Colombia, I was over in Colombia, our trade union delegation a few years ago, they're all very well aware that the paramilitaries are all being funded through the drugs trade, and the CIA and the Americans are turning a blind eye to it. There's a new film that's just come out, a Hollywood film called Kill the Messenger, which is about the investigations by a journalist called Gary Webb into the whole Iran-Contra affair, because he uncovered the fact they were bringing massive amounts of cocaine into the United States through MENA Air Base in Arkansas, incidentally, which implicated the Clintons. And the film is a bowdler, right? It's not a full-on version of the truth. It's a sort of Hollywood version of the truth after all these years. But nevertheless, the essentials of the film are correct. And it was essentially pointing the finger at the CIA as major drug runners, not just any old drug runners, major drug runners. If you are the CIA, of course, you're in a strong position to be the kingpins, because you can take down anybody else that's the competition. And a lot of Mexicans believe that certain cartels in Mexico are being supported by the CIA, other cartels are being wiped out by the CIA. But anyway, the film is called Kill the Messenger, and it's a Hollywood film which is actually on release at the moment. So if anybody wants to go and, you know, get a basic education and all this stuff, then they should go and see that film.
And there's a very good book, of course, as well, called Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, all about that. It's called The CIA, The Contras and the Crack Cocaine Explosion. So in a way, what we're hearing is that these are the drugs of choice of the bad guys, aren't they? Heroin and cocaine.
Well, it's just the drugs of choice for people who want to make money, because they are very, very profitable. And
it's what that money's being used for, is what I'm trying to say. Well, it's why I say the bad
guys. Well, what the money's being used for is to fund, for example, Alto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, the far-right paramilitaries in Colombia. And similar groups in around the world. I mean, a lot of these Islamic jihadi groups are funded by drugs, but they're actually being facilitated by Western intelligence services. And the important take-home for everybody listening to this and with regular listeners to this show is, don't believe what you're being told in the mainstream media. If just simple internet searches will bring up, if you just put Iran-Contra into an internet search, a lot of information will pop onto your screen immediately. And basically, nothing has changed. In all these years, as you pointed out, Colonel Oliver North was not prosecuted, was not punished. He was pardoned by George Bush Sr., and he's now actually a chat show host in the US and a famous celebrity worth millions. So far from being punished, he's actually been promoted. And that's why nothing has changed in the way this world works.
Yes, we'll be hearing a bit more later on about why the death of investigative journalism, particularly TV journalism here in Britain. But you can hear all on your award-winning, we've just won an award yesterday, which is the Small Radio Station Award by the Radio Academy for the Southwest of England, that is BCFM.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And right from the international drug trade to pharmaceutical drugs and Frenchay Hospital. And I'm joined here in the studio by Barbara Harris, who's from Save Frenchay Community Hospital Group. Hi, Barbara, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Thank you for inviting me.
Would you like to just tell us how you formed your group and what's happening now up at Frenchay?
We started out in 2004, Joan Kent and I, on a public involvement group. And the idea was that they had members of the public to look at the issue of determining which was the best site, Southmead or Frenchay, for a new acute hospital. Well, we were very innocent in those days. We started out with the best of intentions, but it soon became absolutely clear that this issue was already settled for Southmead. We went to a meeting in March 2005, at which the decision for Southmead as the acute site and Frenchay to have a community hospital was given formal approval. We then continued keeping a watching brief on this, but we were told from the outset not to worry, there will be a community on the Frenchay site. And in those days, it was due to have 84 intermediate care beds and 28 mental health beds, which later fell by the wayside. So time went by and the new hospital, you know, came into being, started to be built. And then the South Gloucestershire Primary Care Trust formed a Frenchay project board to have a look at the issue of what was to go on the Frenchay site. And in order to do this, they did another health needs assessment to assess, you know, the population requirement for intermediate care, which is what a community hospital provides. It was also to have outpatients, diagnostic facilities. It was to be a renal hub. And the idea was that the community hospital would provide step-up and step-down beds into and out of the acute. So, for instance, if there was patient who needed an acute treatment but was not physically well enough, they could step up into the community hospital bed, be stabilised, then go into the acute Southmead hospital for their treatment. And the same thing would happen for those patients who were being discharged from the acute hospital. They would, if they still required intermediate care, they would be able to step down into the community hospital beds. Now, this project continued. There was a Frenchay project board with lay people on it, and it went on for 3 years. They brought in somebody called Beatrix Maynard, who did a great deal of good work. And finally, they produced a report called Emerging Themes. And it was then decided there would be 68 community hospital beds on the Frenchay site. And we were quite buoyed up because we thought, oh, at last, you know, we're getting somewhere. Because in our opinion, actually, they should have put the community care in first and then the community hospital, then decide what capacity they needed in the acute. Which, of course, this new acute hospital at Southmead only has 800 beds, where once there were 1,600, then reduced to 1,120. So they have reduced the acute bed base just at the point that the population is about to take off.
But hang on a minute, Barbara, because it doesn't really matter where these beds are, does it? They don't have to be at Frenchay. They could be somewhere else completely, so long as the beds are there. And actually, the land in Frenchay, as I'm sure the developers will point out to you, is actually much more valuable for luxury housing.
No, that's not the issue. They have reserved a site for the community hospital, 6.8 acres. But the point that we're arguing about is that having agreed on a community hospital and having produced a tender document in the official journal of the European Union, we actually thought we were on our way. The next thing we knew, they disbanded what had then become the Frenchay User Group, and they shut the whole thing down. They took out the tender, shut the whole thing down. In came the clinical commissioning groups, and the clinical lead on this went to the Frenchay User Group and said, there's no money for the care in a community hospital. We're going to have to make do with what we have. Well, what we have is grossly inadequate, because basically what we have at Southmead now is a hot site, over 700 or more patients being admitted every week. Our interest, our concern is for those patients who, many of whom are being discharged prematurely, back into the community, some go to nursing homes, because the clinical commissioning group say there's no funding for a community hospital and they want to put patients coming out of that hospital being discharged into nursing home beds. We are saying, no, that's not it. That's not intermediate care.
Okay, well, I'll agree with you. But where do we go from here?
Right. This issue was treated as a contentious issue a year ago by South Gloucestershire Council, and they referred it to the Secretary of State, who referred it to the Independent Reconfiguration Panel. They came back and they said, well, there's no decision for us to look at, and there's still no decision, despite the fact that people, we keep turning up waiting for answers. The NHS do not provide any answers. But they also said further work needs to be carried out. We should be shown the bed audit that was carried out in 2013, which we thankfully now have, which shows that there is a requirement for intermediate care beds. Capacity, which we can never get any answers from the NHS on. The population figure. They wanted greater clarity about the model of care. They wanted to know precisely what outpatients and diagnostic services would be and where. And they wanted a new approach to patient and public involvement. We've had none of that. We've waited 9 months. We keep turning up to meetings. So we have finally decided that South Gloucestershire Council's Public Health and Health Scrutiny Committee have not been able to get any answers from the NHS, which means that we are being deprived both by the democratic process, and also we have a statutory need, well, we have a statutory right to take part in matters involving our healthcare provision.
Okay, but I have to ask you to wind up now, Barbara, and how do people follow this and maybe take part in what you're up to?
Will they please Google Save French Aid Community Hospital e-petition?
Or your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Well, however they get there, South Gloucestershire's own, if you want. But we would like them. We only have until the 10th of December. But this is an all Bristol problem. North Somerset, Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, South Gloucestershire. It's not just North Bristol. No, it's a whole Bristol
but how,
problem.
How do people find you? Contact you?
Well, they can contact me if they ring the station. I will leave my email address.
And also maybe via Daphne and Southwest Whistleblowers.
Yes, Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. That's SWAG. If they put SWAG into a search engine, they'll get that and they can go on there and make contact with us.
Okay. That's Barbara Harris from Save French Aid Community Hospital Group. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you. I hope they do sign our petition.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now back to our interview. We started last week. We conclude this week by with Tim Tate, who lives in the southwest. He's the former Yorkshire Television documentary producer that made the film Conspiracy of Silence, all about paedophile ring and drug running going on in the Republican Party in the United States. And here he is talking to me about the end, what he says, basically, in the 1990s of television investigative journalism. What's happened to investigative television documentaries in Britain?
They don't exist, is the simple answer. It was starting around the time we made the Conspiracy of Silence film. The reason Yorkshire Television was contracted to make films for Discovery was that First Tuesday, the documentary series which it had been making for ITV, was cancelled. ITV decided to reorganise itself. It cancelled First Tuesday, which was, in my view, the best documentary series there has ever been on television, bar none. Both investigative and non-investigative. It wasn't purely investigative. Because it was cancelled, the brand First Tuesday was sold to Discovery. The series was to be called First Tuesday on Discovery. And that's what we made Conspiracy of Silence as. When Discovery behaved as it did, the rest of the series carried on. Yorkshire Television got their money, and in fact I made another film for Discovery under that brand. But there was no attempt at doing anything investigative. One of the most memorable First Tuesdays was made by a colleague of mine, and it was called 4 Hours in My Life. It won a raft of awards, and it did what no one else had done, which was to track down the US soldiers who had massacred an entire village, the My Lai village, during the Vietnam War. It was, until the story of what happened, there had been a commission of inquiry which had been largely, inevitably, a whitewash. Kevin's film, Kevin Sim, was the director, and who's, to my mind, a genius. It is the most powerful, the most affecting film, and if you get the chance to see it, you should. 4 hours in My Lai. That was just one of many. When I arrived, that I made a film, and again, it's an indication of how seriously First Tuesday and Yorkshire Television then took filmmaking. I made a film with a Chinese dissident, probably China's most effective and most loathed from the Chinese government point of view dissident in exile, a man called Harry Wu, who had been in its brutal penal labour camp system for 19 years, had escaped, had been stateless and living essentially on the streets, initially in the States, and had, without a passport and without any documents, decided to go back and take the first hidden camera inside this penal system. And I got in. Harry had shot all that footage. There were hours and hours of this. And Harry and I made a film about the penal camp system, not just about his experiences and not just using his undercover footage, but the Chinese penal system is a fact. They're a series of factories. It is the world's biggest producer of prison slave labour goods. And if you go into shops in the UK and you find Chinese made products, you're probably going to find that some part of them has been made by slave labour in Chinese prisons. And we conducted a number of undercover stings of Chinese government companies doing exactly this. It took a year to make that film. It cost £250,000 in 1992 and 1993. And Yorkshire Television and First Tuesday just said, it takes how long it takes. You spend what you need to spend. This film needs to be made. And that's what the attitude was. That, frankly, if you want to take an overview, is bloody inconvenient for governments. No government likes investigative journalists poking their nose into scandals, into asking questions. And much less do they like them spending years digging away and finding the truth. And I think it, whether or not that is the reason why the requirements for serious investigative filmmaking have been withdrawn, it is certainly convenient for government that they have been withdrawn.
So what's the consequences of not making these films that need to be made?
I draw an analogy. Again, this was a First Tuesday, a Yorkshire Television film. The Guildford Four, four Irish men who were wrongly convicted of a bombing and who spent years and years and years in prison until a Yorkshire Television documentary, I think it was a First Tuesday, proved that they were innocent and they were finally released. Similarly, Granada's World in Action did the same for the Birmingham Six. Had it not been for Granada and for Yorkshire, the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four would never have seen the light of day again. Those gross miscarriages of justice, the ruin of those men's lives, would never have been exposed. Who's doing that today? Who would fund that today? It took the teams that did that, for whom I have the utmost respect, it took years of patient, forensic investigation that was paid for. What television company, what television network would do that today? I don't think there is one. Have those injustices gone away? is there not ever going to be a Guildford 4 or a Birmingham 6 again? And of course there is. It's just that people like us, the old dinosaurs, aren't funded to do that work anymore. In British television, what's happened to The Cook Report, to World in Action, to This Week, to John Pilger's series, groundbreaking series, Viewpoint, all of those challenging, difficult, important series, they existed, apart from the fact there were people who believed in making them, they existed by law, they existed by regulation. If you wanted, as an ITV company, to have a license to broadcast, be it Yorkshire Television, Central Television, Thames, you had to pass a quality threshold, and it was built into your license that you would broadcast and make a certain number of current affairs programmes, of investigations, of documentaries, of arts programming, of religious programming. It was there in stone, and you had to meet it. Those requirements have been successively removed. Every government since the late 80s has whittled away at them. There is now no requirement. ITV, as a commercial broadcaster, has no requirements under its license to broadcast any number of hours of anything. It can do exactly what it wants. That has a knock-on effect. Broadcasting is an incredibly delicate ecosystem. If ITV doesn't do it, because it's expensive and doesn't necessarily yield the huge audiences, Channel 4 doesn't feel that it has to do it. If Channel 4 doesn't feel that it has to do it, the BBC doesn't feel that it has to do it. It's easier and cheaper not to do it. And when the pressure of your peers, your rivals, isn't there, there's no one keeping broadcasters honest.
If you were still sitting in your seat at First Tuesday, what sort of thing documentaries would you be pitching now, would you be like to be making? Because, you know, I wonder what it is we're not seeing. And I often think about television, it's what they're not showing us, which is really the most important thing we need to know.
I went to work for Al Jazeera, which in 2008... And I went to work for Al Jazeera because they were then the only broadcaster, and it is a British as well as an international broadcaster, willing to do serious programmes. And I made a number of films for them. As a freelance, I was always a freelance. At one point, I came across a story that I thought needed to be told. There were three whistleblowers from within Boeing who made allegations in court and in court documents that Boeing had knowingly put up into the skies 1,600 planes, the most commonly used passenger planes, with bogus, ill-fitting and unlawful parts. I had their documents. I had Boeing's internal documents. They are absolutely correct. I took that, first of all, to Channel 4 as a story. I got an email back eventually from the commissioning editor at Channel 4 saying, and I quote again, "You cannot go round making allegations about well-respected international companies." End quote. Now, actually, that's our job, provided those allegations are provable. I took it to ITV. ITV said, yeah, it's a good story, but it'll cost us a lot to have lawyers look at this, so I don't think we'll bother. And the BBC never bothered to answer. Al Jazeera, to their credit, funded it, and we made the film, and if anyone wants to view it, it's online, because all Al Jazeera's films are online. It's called On a Wing and a Prayer, and it should make everyone very nervous. It's an hour-long film. It's an hour-long investigation. That's what you're not seeing on British television now.
One would like to think that there still is a little investigative journalism going on, and if somebody is aware, a whistleblower, of some sort of injustice, that there's somewhere they can go.
Yes and no. I do think there are places where you can get investigative journalism on the airwaves. I think Jazeera is a fine example. I mean, I made a succession of those films, and they continue to make films which cause trouble, and I think that is terrific. It's equally true that Conspiracy of Silence, someone leaked the tape or a cut of the film to somebody else, and it's up on YouTube, and that's great. So that, you know, you could look at that as a twinkle of hope. But otherwise, no. If you're a whistleblower, you have to have confidence that the people you talk to, A, can do something with the information and will do something with the information, and B, will protect you. And I go back to World in Action in the 80s. It made a very brave film about, I think, British Steel, and it did so on the basis of documents provided by whistleblowers, and two of its journalists went to prison rather than revealing their source. That wouldn't happen these days. There is no one, and I mean no one, prepared to fund proper investigative journalism. The Guardian will tell you that it does, but The Guardian is talking nonsense. If you look at what The Guardian publishes, its scoops that it trumpets, Snowden primarily, they came in from freelancers. They were not generated from within. It's only lone, awkward squad members who carry on digging that ever provide this stuff. It never, never happens within major media organisations.
Bringing you national news on the hour.
And don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a man's been jailed for life after travelling from America to the UK and stabbing a brother and sister he'd met online. Tim Jones reports.
Police say Shane Coffey from Boston had planned the attack with disturbing precision. He'd been in contact with the two victims through online gaming, but continued...